Welcome, everyone. This is the second office hours session for Economic History 810, the Sovereign Debt Crisis. And we're at the office hours, so I'll turn over everyone's questions. Just so you guys know, I think I'm going to post most of them for the fourth week, but just keep your eyes open. This course is happening in real time, as it were, so every day there's new news articles that pop up about what's going on over in Europe, and I debate, gee, should I assign this for the class or not? So anyway, just keep in mind that the syllabus is a work in progress, that I may be putting other stuff in there. Like I say, I'll try to, if I'm posting anything, I'll try to put it in the fourth week at this point, so you still have time to read it, but just keep your eyes peeled that I may be adding stuff. Okay, Benjamin says, I really enjoyed the debate yesterday, but I thought the time was too short for the initial presentations. It's a shame that after putting together a slide presentation, there's insufficient time to use them all. I would have deleted the time allotted to questions from the audience and given more time to presentation questions and rebuttal by the professors who are debating. I do think that this is a terrific... Oops, got bumped. I do think this is a terrific way for students to learn. Can you comment on this? Well, thanks for saying that. I'm glad you liked it. In case people don't know, what he's talking about is Friday, September 2nd, Professor Carl Smith, who's from UNC, I believe, and I had a debate, and it was like it was a webinar. Like, we did it through the Mises Academy's platform. And the format was, we wanted to keep the formal debate itself limited to an hour. And so we were trying, you know, we were debating the format with each other. We were trying to figure out, okay, how do we do it? So we did 12-minute opening statements and then an 8-minute rebuttal, or whatever you call it, response, and then 5 minutes each for like quick Q&A between us, and then 5-minute closing. So I think if I said that right, that adds up to 60 minutes. And then we turned over to the students. So what happened, I mean, and I knew this was going to happen, but I was preparing my PowerPoint, and because we're doing it with this format, it was easy to have a PowerPoint. I told Carl that, you know, just so you know, I'm going to have a PowerPoint in the first 12-minute deal, in case you want to have one too. And what we were debating was whether government spending could play an important role in economic growth. So I figured that one or both of us might need to use charts and things. So what happened is that, is what typically happens, you start going through it and you run out of time. And so it happened to Carl and me. Like I said, when I was doing my PowerPoint, I kind of knew I was trying to stuff too much material in there. But what ended up happening is you had that 8-minute fallback period, and that's what we did. And the other thing, too, is we had, I think both of us had a few slides in there that we weren't planning on using, but we just wanted to have them at our fingertips in case the other guy brought something up that we wanted to be able to point to a slide and say, no, that's wrong because of blah, blah, blah. So some of that stuff was overkill on purpose. As far as the time, you know, it's tough. You're right. I felt like if we had, you know, yeah, what you said, I think Benjamin is, was it Benjamin who asked that? I think so. Was right, yeah. That the time that we allocated at the end of the session for when we were just fielding questions from the participants, like the people who watched it, Carl and I, you know, had the actual debate itself been a little bit longer, I think, yeah, that would have felt more natural. Certainly, I didn't feel like when the hour was over, oh my gosh, this thing is dragging on forever and ever. I mean, I was having to stop myself because I had so many points I wanted to make it because I didn't have enough time. The thing is, though, when you go to advertising, because the only way those things work and the only way we can hope to get bigger guns in the future to come in and debate us is if we think there's going to be a big turnout. Right? I mean, I don't want to divulge the specifics, but Carl got a share of the revenue from that event, and that was partly why he did it, is because he knew if we had a big turnout, you know, he'd make a decent amount of money for an hour or two of his time. So that's the idea. I mean, we're thinking if that thing was successful, and then we can, you know, if we keep doing this once in a while and get more and more people who pay to watch the thing live, then we can go, you know, to whoever, guys from University of Chicago or something, you know, people whose names you may have heard of, you know, Dean Baker or whatever, Brad DeLong, if we want to go that route, whatever. We're just, you know, we're bouncing ideas around, but it certainly makes them more willing and more likely to do it if they think they're going to get a decent paycheck out of it. So the problem then is when you advertise, even though once you're in there and you're watching, you're right, yeah, that hour goes by so fast and you wish it was longer. But a lot of people, when they see things, something like that, if you say it's going to be an hour and a half debate, I think to a lot of people, especially between economists, that sounds like, oh my gosh, I want to spend 90 minutes on a Friday night watching two economists argue with each other. You know, how about I just gouge out my eyes instead? Even though, like I say, if you go ahead and start watching it and get into it, you realize, oh no, I want this thing to keep going. So, I mean, I'm not going to name names, but just so you know, when we gave that format, when I shared that format with some other people internally, when we were still just dreaming up the idea, and I said, yeah, Carl and I had tentatively agreed on this distribution of the time, at least one person said, oh, wow, that's way too long for the opening presentation. You're going to bore people with that. Whereas I knew that, no, we're going to be running out of time. 12 minutes is not nearly enough to do your opening remarks on a topic like this. So I'm just saying that there's this huge difference in perception between when you're watching the thing versus when you're looking at someone describe it. And it can, you know, like I say, we wanted to limit it to an hour because we thought that we'd get more people. Now, maybe next time around we'll change it. I'm not sure. We need to all discuss that. The other thing, too, Benjamin, as to the Q&A with the people who come, we were trying to think of ways, like, how do we get people to really want to tune into this? And so we thought that was one of the things, is if you tune in, then there's a chance that your question's going to get answered by the debaters. And so we, you know, again, that's partly why we included that feature. It's sort of like I listen to a lot of talk radio, partly because I often am the guest on shows like that, so I just want to stay abreast of it and make sure I know what it normally sounds like so that if I'm going to be on it, I can sort of pace myself and try to sound like other guests, at least in terms of the style. And I can't stand it when people call in. Even though technically it's talk radio and the ostensible purpose is, or the, you know, the original format was a guy just taking calls from people and letting people vent, I can't stand that. I'd rather just listen to the host of the show pontificate on the news rather than listen to people call in. So maybe that's what you were getting frustrated with too, is that you would rather just Carl and me talk rather than having to field a question from a layperson, as it were. But that's, I think some people think differently, like people who are not as geeky perhaps as you are, that it grounds and it keeps the thing, you know, realistic or something when a regular person comes and asks questions that sort of focus the discussion. So anyway, I appreciate your feedback, and we will consider altering the framework, but I'm just reminding you in case you didn't know, or telling you in case you didn't know, that the only way these things really work is if we get enough people who sign up, because otherwise we're not going to be able to get a busy person who's kind of important to come and do it. Since, you know, from their point of view, it's not that prestigious to debate somebody on the Mises website or something, you know. So that's the idea. Whereas if we have a bunch of people turning out to watch the thing, then there's at least a paycheck they can get from it. Okay. Another question from Benjamin. I have asked you before about possible negative blowback from your choices of whom you pick to debate. Professor Smith has never even read The General Theory, Keynes's book, I guess, as he states in a written answer to one of my questions. I really thought he was a terrific person and very cordial, and unlike Krugman, he doesn't have an attitude problem, just saying. That's funny. Okay, yeah, I mean, that's partly why I approached him. I guess it's fine to say, I don't think this would hurt Carl's feelings if he knew this, so I guess I can say it publicly. He wasn't the first person I approached. He was like the fifth person. And I don't mean on this narrow topic. I mean I had approached other people on different types of topics because we were trying to think, you know, we don't want this opening debate to be a flop and 14 people sign up, because then, you know, that might kill the project. Other people might be afraid to do it and be embarrassed if nobody signs up. So we wanted to make sure this opening one was something that was interesting to a lot of Mises.org readers, So I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to say who I asked, but I asked several prominent figures whose names you guys would all recognize, and they didn't want to do it for various reasons. Some of them thought, no, you should go take out a Keynesian. You don't want to take me on. Why are we having a sort of friendly dispute? And then other people, I think they just didn't like the combative context of a debate. They would rather, write blog posts back and forth, but they didn't want to be put on the spot in an actual live debate. So the reason I approached Carl was that I guess it was back in January, I think. He was going back and forth with this guy, Jim Manzi, who writes for National Review, and I like Manzi a lot. Manzi's a very down-to-earth, but he seems very honest guy, but also very intelligent, and he likes to go dig up the data, so he's really good in the global warming stuff, where Manzi just goes and wades through the IPCC reports and so forth. So he doesn't just say stuff like, oh, it's a hoax, or, oh, those guys are a bunch of liars. He'll go and take the government or the IPCC, which is the, supposedly authoritative organization on this stuff that compiles all the so-called consensus on this, and he'll show that, no, across a suite of models, look at how the temperatures move, and according to their own projections, economic damages are only going to be blah, blah, blah. And so he'll use the official body's own numbers to sort of tone down the rhetoric of what some people are claiming. So anyway, Manzi was in a sort of blog back and forth with this guy, Carl Smith, whom I had never really heard of before, and that's what got me into it. And so then I started emailing Carl about Keynesian stuff, saying, because what I think what they were arguing over was the failure of the stimulus package, and then the nature of how do we now, looking back, evaluate that period. Can we say that's proof, or that's evidence at least, that the stimulus didn't help, or the epistemological issues involved there, with clearly the stimulus didn't deliver what the Romer team said it would, but do we just cut them some slack and say, well, the economy is worse than they thought, or do we say that's prima facie evidence that the stimulus hurt? So that was the kind of stuff they were arguing over, and I was asking Carl, saying to him, I'm not as familiar with these Keynesian models as you are. How do they work? And he was pretty helpful about showing me. In other words, he wanted to help me understand them. His point wasn't to beat me over the head and get me to become a Keynesian, where it seems like when you read Krugman and DeLong, their primary objective, first and foremost, is to convince the reader that they're right. And then, as a secondary task, oh, by the way, let me educate you. Whereas Carl, it seemed to me, he was, first of all, just trying to make sure, does everyone understand how these models work? Make sure you get that. And then, by the way, I think the Fed ought to be inflating more. It was almost an afterthought. So that's why I approached him, because, we didn't want the first debate to, be acrimonious. We didn't want to get somebody agreeing to debate me, and then the guy turned out to be a jerk 20 minutes into it, and it was awkward. So I was pretty sure that there would be a nice back and forth, and Carl and I would, that he would give a strong case for his position, and that I would, but we wouldn't end up biting each other's heads off. Okay. See, Matt Miller says, I'm pretty new to this site, I think by which he means Mises.org. Do you know if there are any plans to repeat some of the earlier Academy courses for those of us who just recently discovered the Austrian school? It would be nice to have an opportunity to catch up. Well, welcome, Matt. Glad you found us and that you're so far learning from it and you want to learn more. For sure. Some of my bigger, more popular classes, we have plans that I'm going to repeat them periodically. It's just we don't want to overtax the market or so, or go back to the well too often, or whatever metaphor you want to use. So my business cycle class was the first one that we did. I'm either going to do that literally again, or do something based on Mises' theory of money and credit that is, along the way, also a course on Austrian business cycle theory. So yeah, that's the I'll be doing that, I think, sometime later this year, this calendar year. The only issue is we just got to make sure, because of Thanksgiving and Christmas, that I have another class that I'm already for sure going to teach. We just got to make sure we can fit it in and it's not too awkward. But that's the plan for that one. I teach an economics principle, an introductory course that's based on my textbook Lessons for the Young Economist. So if depending on, I don't know how, what your background is. I mean, that's sort of almost one stage before Austrian per se. That's just like free market economics, an introduction to people who have never had such an introduction. That I'll probably teach that at least once a year forever. I just don't know. It wouldn't be this calendar year. It maybe would be early in next year is the next time I would offer that. And I can't speak for the other academy professors, because the thing is, a lot of these courses are like just narrow slices of a given person's specialty or area of expertise, and so some are more conducive to just being offered every once in a while versus other ones that are more like one-off events. Like, for example, right now I'm teaching a course on the sovereign debt crisis. And that obviously is not something I'm going to be teaching in 5 years. Well, I hope not. I hope that the crisis isn't still with us in 5 years, even though it probably will be, just because that's a more current events kind of thing. And whereas, you know, economic principles relying on my textbook, clearly that's something that is not going to become obsolete. So to answer your question, yeah, I'm going to, my sort of standalone generic classes that are timeless, yeah, I will always repeat those. It's just a matter of you don't want to offer it too often in the, you don't want to do it twice in the same calendar year, because then you're not going to get many people sign up for it the second time. Okay. Well, what you can do, Matt, is if you're not familiar with it, I would first, how can I put it? The academy is probably not where you want to start. I think what you want to do is maybe find some authors that you like in terms of the Mises Dailies, and then go to their archives and just browse their archives and look through and just click on stuff that way. I'm not, this is going to sound very narcissistic, I think you should look at my archive, because I try to, just the nature, in case you don't know, I don't teach at a school. I used to, but now I'm just a consultant. So I have way more free time than a lot of the other people who are associated with the Institute. So that's partly why I crank out so many daily articles, is because I can. You know, I'm not teaching classes and having to grade papers and stuff, except for Mises Academy things. So in my archives, I make a conscious effort to, when I write something, I've got that whole body of my own work that I'm familiar with to draw on, so I link to a lot of stuff. So if you just start clicking through my past articles on topics that sound interesting to you, they'll link you to other stuff, and that's, you know, a way to start jumping in slowly. Or I guess I mixed metaphors. That's a way to, like, start putting your toe into the water and see, you know, which way you want to go with it. If you want a more formal introduction, though, like if you feel like you're overwhelmed, like, you know, there's just all this stuff and you don't know where to start, Tom Woods at his site has a thing on learning Austrian economics, you know, newcomers, like he has a reading list. You might look at that. And the other thing I was going to say is, instead of even just trying to start with the Mises Academy, go look at the media section at Mises.org. So, you know, you go to Mises.org main page, and then one of the tabs is media, and then go look at past stuff from what's called Mises University. And that's a thing that, in case you don't know what that is, or people listening who don't know what that is, Mises University is like the flagship conference that the Mises Institute puts on every year. It's held the last week of July. And there they have hundreds of undergraduates who go down to Auburn, Alabama and stay there for a week and just learn Austrian economics from scratch. Okay, so if you go and look at some of those main lectures from there, so you want to look at like Jeffrey Herbner, Thomas DiLorenzo, Joe Salerno, me, and who else? I'm probably missing Guido Hulsman and Hans Hoppe. If you go to the media section and click on us, and you look through some of our, you know, some of the videos that they have, just, you know, click on the stuff that's from a recent Mises University, and that will, I think, really help you get up to speed. And then, of course, the main thing is what, if you really want to learn Austrian economics, all you have to do is read Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. I mean, that's, if you read that cover to cover, you would be a very well-informed layperson in terms of Austrian theory. And I have a study guide, too, to help you through that, you know, to make sure you're following it. So I'm just giving you different suggestions. I don't know how you learn and think, you know, some people just want to dabble in things that are interesting. Other people want to, like, see the whole structure and learn it step by step and not miss anything. So depending on what your interests are and the way you learn, those are various approaches. But if you just read Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, you know, he doesn't assume any prior knowledge. He gives you everything you need to know, but it's a fat book. It's like 1,000 pages or something. So that may be more than you want to bite off right now. Okay. One last thing. If you want to just see an easier introduction, Gene Callahan has a book called Economics for Real People. So it's a very breezy style. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, you could take to the beach literally, as opposed to Michelle Bachmann saying she takes human action to the beach. So you could try that. If Rothbard's book is too big and intimidating and you don't know if you want to have that kind of time commitment right now, check out Gene's book, because that was the whole purpose for which they commissioned that book. They wanted someone, you know, they told Gene, we want you to write a book that when someone says, what the heck is this Austrian economics, we can hand them a book that is obviously not going to condense the entire corpus of Austrian thought into a single little book that's easy to read, but that will give them the basics so that people will walk away from that book understanding, oh, okay, that's what makes the Austrian school special. That's why there's so many people that think Austrian economics is important. So you can check out that book, too. Okay. Benjamin says, Jim Rickards says that the gold price is reacting to federal debt that the market sees as payable only by devaluation of the dollar. Taking that as a given, along with with Congress's attitude currently, how exactly does Krugman expect the government to stimulate in the trillions of dollars? Just how would that happen? What about the addition of trillions to the debt? It seems like you always ask variants of the same question on this topic, Benjamin. Well, it's because Krugman doesn't agree with Jim Rickards' perspective. All right? I'm not saying Krugman's right. I'm just saying when you're asking, you know, how can Krugman possibly believe this? How is he so stupid? In Krugman's mind, it's Rickards who's stupid. Krugman, you know, will look at conventional metrics and say, are you kidding me? The U.S. right now, yeah, the debt has gone up a lot over the last few years, but we're in a huge economy. $1 trillion is big to you and me and to a corporation, but it's not big to the U.S. government. And if you look at things like government debt compared to GDP, the U.S. is percentage right now is lower than a lot of European countries. And it's true, some of those countries are right now the ones that are getting attacked by speculators and so forth, and their bond yields are going up because people are worried about default. But there are other countries for which that isn't the case. Like Japan has much higher debt-to-GDP ratio than the U.S., and it's not like right now the Japanese government is unable to borrow on decent terms. It's not that, you know, interest rates in Japan are sky high. The because people think the Japanese government's going to default. So Krugman's viewpoint is that, yes, long term we need to contain the deficit, but he doesn't think it's a matter of right now, oh my gosh, we have to slash spending. He thinks that a trillion here, a trillion there over the next few years is a drop in the bucket, that really the long-term problem is what's called entitlement spending, in particular Medicare. That's the thing, too, that Krugman likes to point out, is that people say, oh, it's Social Security and Medicare. No, it's not even really Social Security. That by itself, yeah, Social Security is underfunded, meaning right now if we don't change the rules on it, even on the government's own projections, there's less revenue coming in from Social Security taxes than ultimately they're going to have to pay out to beneficiaries. But it's not that big of a mismatch. He said the thing that is really destroying right now the long-term federal budget is the current projections of how much Medicare is going to have to spend under the current rules. So that's why Krugman thinks, that's why we need healthcare reform. And Krugman thinks it would be great if we had a single payer system to contain the rising healthcare costs, because Krugman thinks a free market in healthcare is a bad idea. So that, and now, and then too, when you say the gold price, I mean, that was, I think you're a regular reader of Mises.org, and you probably, I think you even mentioned it in an email to me, Benjamin, but that's the one area where I can't believe Krugman is saying this with a straight face. So I'm, don't misunderstand me. I share your pain, as it were. You're right. Krugman drives me up the wall, too. That's why I read him every day. I can't look away. It's like, what crazy thing is he going to say next? But in terms of his worldview, yeah, the way he handles the gold price is, before he just said, well, hey, it's volatile. So, yeah, it's way up, but, you know, for all we know, it could have been way down. Yeah, it bounces around a lot. Who cares? So that was the way he dealt with it before. And then more recently, he latched onto some theory that this guy, you know, he read some other guy making the case that, well, you know, the gold market is actually pretty shallow, that there's not that much gold changing hands every day, as opposed to like the bond market or something. And so it really would only take a few big buyers to really drive the price up. And so then Krugman added his own twist to the theory, saying he thinks it's because of Glenn Beck. And more generally, all the conservative talk radio people and television hosts who have scared their listeners into thinking the socialist Muslim Obama is taking over run to gold because Bernanke is going to debase the currency, and that it wouldn't take that big of an increase in people just trying to hoard physical gold to make the price do what it has been doing. So on the one hand, you and I and Rickards and Krugman all agree that people are worried about the dollar being debased, and so that's why they're rushing into gold, and that's why the price is high. The difference is Krugman thinks that's a ridiculous fear, and that it's not that the world over and all the smart people are rushing to gold. It's that a relatively small group of people who just do whatever Glenn Beck says are rushing into gold, and because he claims the gold market is actually not that liquid, if just a relatively small amount of people did that and were fooled by Glenn Beck's paranoid warnings, then you'd see the gold price shoot up like we've seen it shoot up. So that's, like I said, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, well, gee, there's two sides to this, Benjamin. There's your view and Krugman's, and I'm not sure who's right. I mean, obviously, I agree with you and Rickards. I'm just explaining, you know, you're asking how can Krugman sleep at night without his head exploding, and this is what he has done in his worldview to reconcile everything. So that's what I'm saying. He would have a lot easier time of things, and I would not, how can I put it? I could chalk it up to just honest disagreement if gold weren't going through the roof. But these people who are saying that what Bernanke is doing is totally fine, and in fact he's not doing enough, and nobody's worried about inflation, I don't understand how they can just so easily ignore the silver and gold price blowing up over the last 3 years. Because they're right. They do have a good, let me put it this way, that's what gives me hope or fear that our worries are correct. Because if the silver and gold weren't doing that, then I would really start to think, geez, maybe I'm just misanalyzing the situation. Maybe the dollar's not going to collapse. But the fact that gold keeps going up and silver keeps going up shows me that, okay, there's lots of people who are looking at this the way I am, and, you know, maybe the market's just segregated at this point, and we're rushing into gold and silver, and the other people who are worried about deflation are rushing into the bond market. And so that's why you have this weird outcome where bond yields are very tame, and conventional measures of what's called the market's forecast of price inflation show that the market doesn't think anything unusual is going to happen over the next 10 years, whereas looking at stuff like gold and silver, it looks like people think Armageddon is coming. And so maybe that the answer is as simple as that, that the people who think Armageddon's coming are rushing into gold and silver, and the people who think, no, we're going to be like Japan, aren't going to buy gold and silver. Why would they do that? They're going to rush into bonds, and that's pushing down yields. So that's – anyway, summary for that train of thought is to say it is – I think it's very awkward for people like Krugman or Scott Sumner who thinks that Bernanke is engaging in tight money and so forth. The price of gold and silver is, I think, a very awkward thing for them, and they just poo-poo it. They just say, well, who cares? That's just a piece of metal. The bond market is much deeper, and there's a lot more people involved in the bond market, and so that's a much more accurate signal, whereas gold and silver prices, that they could be fluctuating for all sorts of reasons. And so just to round out your question, or my answer to your question, Benjamin, in Krugman's model, if the government, if the U.S. government right now borrowed another $2 trillion next week and spent it, he doesn't think anything bad would happen. He thinks that would be great. He says, in particular, he says that would not make interest rates in the U.S. go through the roof, because right now he still thinks the so-called market clearing interest rate is negative. And so the worst that, so even if by borrowing $2 trillion more, it pushed up interest rates 5 percentage points, which is huge. If right now the market's trying to have interest rates of -1%, all that would mean is interest rates would end up being 4% in his mind, which is fine. And then in his mind, the extra spending would stimulate the economy, would create a bunch of jobs. There'd be a lot more tax revenue coming in. So that $2 trillion in borrowing and spending would actually only work out to, I'm just making this up, only work out to $1.5 trillion of a higher deficit, because it would generate so much more economic activity that maybe $500 billion more in tax revenues would come in. So he's saying on net, you wouldn't even be borrowing the full amount once you accounted for everything. And then also he thinks long term that would just, that would help, because now you create more jobs, so you don't need to spend as much on unemployment benefits and food stamps, blah, blah, blah. So expenditures could be lower over the next few years because of that. And so what he's saying is, in the grand scheme of things, to do what he thinks is the government ought to do to really help the economy get out of this slump, he probably thinks would just add maybe $1 trillion to the debt over the next 5 years relative to what would otherwise be the case, even though he wants to spend $2 trillion right now. He thinks that, you know, relative to the trajectory, because it's going to boost revenues and lower what expenditures would otherwise have to be. And then he says, yeah, $1 trillion sounds like a lot, but you know what? Not to the U.S. government, not on a 10-year timeline. $1 trillion is nothing. That's what he thinks. Okay, Jeffrey Ludwig says, regarding the debate, there was a question I saw that got passed over but that I found interesting. It had to do with the plucking model proposed by Milton Friedman, in which a boom is correlated with the preceding bust rather than a bust being correlated with the preceding boom. I looked up the plucking model, and there was a piece by Roger Garrison that said that the plucking model doesn't pose any problems for the ABCT, Austrian Business Cycle Theory, saying that the plucking model is based on a different level of aggregation. In short, he said that the level of aggregation Friedman uses in the plucking model is superficial, but the Austrians would disaggregate some of the figures that go into the plucking model. I was wondering what your take is on this. Okay. Well, let me just explain a little bit of the context for people who don't know what you're talking about. So Milton Friedman one time proposed what he called a plucking model of business cycles. And now I don't know if he just threw it out there as an interesting hypothesis, like, hey guys, let's just think outside the box and let's consider this, or if Friedman really believed in it. In other words, if he was saying, this is what I think is going on and we should all, you know, you guys should all come around to my point of view. Because sometimes academics, an interesting idea occurs to them and they just throw it out there just to say, hey, let's make sure we consider this possibility, even though they're not sure it's right or not. So with the I'm not sure how much credence Friedman himself gave to this idea. But anyway, what he said is, you know, we've just assumed all along when we studied the business cycle that the cycle is characterized by first there's a boom period, and then it, you know, it peaks, and then there's a contraction that sets in, and then there's a recession, and then there's a trough, and then there's a recovery, and that's the full cycle. And then, you know, I'm like, start again. And so he's saying, but what if it's the other way around? What if really the business cycle is characterized by you're going along, you're chugging along, and then for some reason the economy falls into a recession, and then it hits a trough, and then it comes out in a, you know, in a recovery, and then you sort of overshoot. The coming out of the recovery, the economy is growing like going like gangbusters, and then we have what the boom period, and then the boom tapers out, and then you crash again. But the cycle should be characterized by first there's a recession, and then there's a recovery, which eventually feels like an economic boom. And the reason he called it the plucking model is he said that what could be happening, and the reason that this also dovetails with economic theory is it depends. If Friedman's right, then the way we approach recessions and boom periods is totally different, both as just theorists trying to understand it and also as giving policy advice. So he said, what if what's happening is it's not that something is overheating during the boom period that then necessitates a crash later on, but what if what happens is the economy is going along fine and then something goes wrong with it to make it go below its potential, and then the recovery and the boom is just the economy bouncing back. And so the plucking model term comes from the fact that, like, what if the economy is like a string? So from your guys' point of view, you're picturing like this. You know, there's a growth path of the economy, and in the recession, if you picture just pulling it down, pulling that string down, or I guess from your point of view, pulling the string down this way. Okay, so that you're going along, and actually, let me do it on the whiteboard. So, okay, so here's the normal growth path of the economy, and then Friedman's saying, what if, you know, it's coming along, and then it gets pulled below its potential, and then it bounces back up. So he's saying if you view this thing as like a guitar string, something pulls it down or plucks it down, and then it bounces back. So that would have a lot of implications for, like I say, both theoretical understanding and also policy advice. I had thought, boy, I don't want to. You're right. It was Garrison does go into that in his book Time and Money, and maybe he had, Jeffrey, does he have a standalone article on that too? I don't remember off the top of my head. I know he talks about it in his book Time and Money, and I'm just trying to remember. I think I agree with you that my recollection is that Garrison was saying, at a certain level of aggregation in principle, Friedman could be right, but that it still wouldn't pose a problem for the Austrians. But for some reason, I thought, at least when I was teaching it to my students, that I didn't think it fit the data very well. I thought that, because if you look at it, let me show you. Because what Friedman is saying, and I think this is the basic idea, if you have something that looks kind of like a sine wave, let's say, and I can't draw it very well freehand with these tools, what he was getting at is normally we look at it that right there is a complete cycle, that you have a boom period first and then a recession. But Friedman was, his point was, how do we know that's the case? That you know, what if the cycle instead is like this? And that right there is, well, I guess that's two cycles. But you get what I'm saying? That what if the beginning of the period is sinking? So let me clear this up. But the way you can know that is if there's a time lag. So if it's more like this, well, then it's clear that the cycles start with a boom and then are followed by a bust and not vice versa, if you guys get what I'm saying. I could have drawn it the other way. So the idea is to see like where the time lags are. And I thought that the time lags, the way that, you know, even if you just do it with a pure econometric analysis, I thought that they showed it was closer to the conventional understanding as opposed to the fucking one, but maybe I'm wrong about that. In any event, I think I agree with you that Garrison was trying to be real agnostic and say, we can handle that. But on the other hand, I want to say, well, no, that doesn't make any sense. If Friedman's right, then the Austrian theory is wrong. That's partly the way I at least stress the Austrian theory, as I say, the Austrians don't look at the recession and say, gee, how do we get the economy out of this? No, the Austrians say the problem where you want to focus on is the preceding boom to understand why we're in the recession. And, of course, that's what I was talking about in the debate last night. And that the reason that's important is if the reason you had that boom was because of a prior boom-bust cycle, and then in that last recession, the way the government got us out of it was by lowering interest rates and engaging in a bunch of so-called fiscal stimulus, and then that set up the unsustainable boom, and now we're in a recession again, that we're only going to get out of this cycle if you stop using those faulty so-called medicine that's actually poison. So I think, we need to grapple with Friedman's hypothesis, and that if the Austrian theory is right, then I think that means he's got to be wrong. Certainly the spirit of what he's saying is wrong. So I'd have to go reread it to see what Garrison was saying. But if Garrison is just means at a certain aggregation of the data, it could look like one thing or the other, okay. But I think what Friedman was saying is maybe the data more support the plucking model than the conventional understanding. And if that turned out to be the case, it would be, I think, problematic for the Austrian theory. Okay, Benjamin says, you are quite prolific with your easy-to-understand examples. I really love your gnome story. Do you make this stuff up yourself? Well, thank you. I make up. I mean, I certainly made up that one, and most of the stuff I make up. Usually I'll try to, if I'm explicitly borrowing an argument or thought experiment from someone, usually I'll credit the person unless it's just something that's so ubiquitous that everybody uses it. Like to say, if you're talking about free trade, it's common to say stuff like, well, I mean, you could certainly create jobs in a certain sector by cutting off trade. For example, if people in Alaska put up a huge tariff on oranges, then it might make sense for them to have greenhouses in Alaska to grow tropical fruits, but that would be crazy. And I didn't make that example up, but that's so standard. It's not like I would credit somebody with that. But yeah, the thing you're talking about, for people who don't know, I probably should write that up, because that is something. That might help people understand. The issue is, one of the things Carl Smith brought up, and others do as well, is to talk about the fact that, look, right now there are idle resources, and there's no crowding out. That these free market guys, so not just the Austrians, but the Chicago School guys too, when they warn us that, oh no, if the government spends money, that just diverts resources from the private sector, that's wrong, the Keynesians claim. That there's guys sitting on their couch right now without a job, and there's factories with idle capacity. So how can you say that the market works if the government spends money hiring those guys to get off the couch and go to the factory and make more stuff? Then clearly, socially, we're better off. Now you have to worry about the distribution of wealth and who's going to pay for those government expenditures and so on, but clearly per capita we're better off having done that, because now there's more stuff being produced every period. And it's not that the guys going to the factory cranking out stuff are reducing output somewhere else, because we just said the guy wasn't working before and the factory wasn't at full capacity. So how can you guys claim that there's a trade-off and that government spending crowds out private spending? So one of the things I pointed out is that in the Austrian view, that's totally wrong. That you can't, where this idea comes from of saying there's idle capacity, and that, well, gee, the economy in 2008 was cranking out a certain amount of GDP, and we have the same amount of machines and workers now as we did then, and yet GDP in real terms is still below what it used to be. So clearly, you know, there's an output gap. That's the standard Keynesian analysis. And I want to say the Austrians would reject that and say, no, it's because you're just focused on these big aggregate statistics. You're not looking at the structure of production and the way that all these capital goods and labor have to interlock with each other in a very particular way that we just take for granted normally, in order for resources to get transformed step by step and get processed and get passed down the line. I mean, if you just follow the life cycle of a loaf of bread, it's actually pretty complicated. And it's a long story, right? That the farmers are out there harvesting wheat, that goes to the miller who turns into flour, that goes to the baker who makes the bread, that goes to the wholesaler. He sells it to some other group, they put it on a truck, drive it to a grocery store, da 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 da. There's a stock boy who takes it off the pallet and puts it on the shelf. You go in as a customer, put it in your cart, you go to the checkout, the cashier got up for work that day and came there to be working the cashier when you were just coming through with a loaf of bread. So it's a lot of stuff going back a long time has to all come together in order for you just to get a loaf of bread as a consumer. And so my point was is that just looking at stuff like, well, gee, how much total capital is there right now compared to 2008? And how much total labor is there? Well, if the numbers haven't gone down, then how come we're not producing as much stuff? That's a very naive question. So the way I tried to illustrate that was to say, just suppose in the middle of the night all these gnomes come out and they rearrange all the capital goods and all the workers in the United States, so that there was a factory before that had all these pieces of equipment, and the gnomes just took them and spread them out over the country. And then there were farms where there was, you know, a bunch of cows, and now those cows got moved around all over the country. And there were a bunch of surgeons in a particular hospital's emergency room, and they got spread out all over the country. And so everyone now wakes up at 8 a.m. the next morning getting ready to go to work, and what the heck? You know, the surgeon goes and realizes he's in Albuquerque when before he was in San Francisco. He doesn't even know where he is, and you know, the guy, the owner of the factory, goes down to his factory expecting to find a bunch of drill presses and an assembly line, and instead he sees a bunch of cows walking around and mooing in his factory. And the farmer goes out to collect the eggs, and he sees a drill press sitting on his land. Right? If that happened, measured output would collapse. I mean, probably lots of people would starve to death. And so if, I'm saying a Keynesian looking at that situation, if they had perfect access to the data, would be baffled. Say, what the heck happened in this economy? There wasn't a drop in capital. You know, we still had the same number of machines in the country that we had yesterday. There wasn't a drop in labor. We have not only the same amount of workers, but the same quantities of various skills in the country as we did yesterday. And yet, for some reason, GDP on an annualized basis, yesterday was, you know, 14.5 trillion, and today it's maybe 1 trillion if we're lucky. So why was there this 90%+ drop in GDP? It doesn't make any sense. It can't be because there's a supply shock, because we have all the, you know, the same amount of capital and labor, so it just must be a collapse in demand. So the government better come in and run a huge deficit, because right now our output gap is like $13.5 trillion. What the heck? So that was the thought experiment, and I just elaborated on it because in the debate I didn't have much time. That's where I was coming from, to try to show in the Austrian view what is so fundamentally wrong in this Keynesian macro approach of the so-called output gap, where what they do is they just look at GDP during the boom period and assume that that's normal and sustainable, and then they just extrapolate. And they say, well, gee, if real GDP was at this level in 2008, since then our workers have gotten more skilled, we've got more people now, and our factories haven't disappeared, so duh, we should be able to produce even more total stuff. And yet we're producing less, so clearly there's not enough demand in the economy. That's what they do. And I'm just showing that Noam story just as a warning that that approach might be overlooking stuff. Okay, we got about 8 minutes left, guys. Matt says, unrelated and possibly dumb question. People talk about gold as protecting from inflation. Wouldn't your average stock also do this? As prices rise, earnings would rise. Assuming valuations hold, the stock price would rise to compensate for the inflation, right? Well, first of all, good question. And yes, generally speaking, stock prices will rise with price inflation. So the thing that would kill you if you have price inflation is if you have assets that are denominated in dollars or whatever the currency is. So if you have a regular bond that's promising to pay you $1,000 per year for the next 10 years, then that's the thing you don't want to be holding if you expect serious price inflation, because you're just going to keep getting $1,000 as prices in general are going up, and $1,000 buys you less and less as time goes on. Whereas you're right, if what you actually own as an asset is not something that gives you a claim on a certain fixed number of dollar bill payments, but instead what you own is a share of a company, what that really says is, okay, you are entitled to whatever the proportion is. Like if you own 10% of the shares, then really it's like saying of all the profits that company earns over the next, well, as long as you own the stock, you in a sense have a legal claim on 10% of those profits. And so as you're right, if prices in general are rising, then the absolute dollar amount of that company's profits you would expect to rise also. So if all prices doubled, then yeah, other things equal, the share price of your stock would double. But now what happens in reality, of course, is monetary inflation doesn't lead to a proportional rise in all prices and at the same speed. So it's not the case that if Bernanke just doubles the money supply, everything doubles automatically and it's just a wash, that some things are going to rise more, some less. And so I think the idea is, if and when that price inflation really does start accelerating, gold and silver are probably going to appreciate faster than other things. And then on top of all that, there's the issue of the profitability itself. Okay, so the problem right now is it's not merely that it's not like we're in a totally healthy economy and then for some crazy reason Bernanke's printing up a bunch of money. The fundamentals of the U.S. economy, as well as a lot of major economies around the world, I think are awful. I think that we should have had a major depression with a small d back in 2008, and they didn't let that happen. They just inflated their way through it and just postponed the problem. So I still think a major crash is coming, and that we've just been living on borrowed time. So given that, I think, let me put you this way. If there were no price inflation going forward, I think the stock market right now is way overvalued and that stock prices would crash. So it's true if prices in general double over the next 6 years, let's say, even though stock prices otherwise would have fallen by 20%, the general doubling might make them go up. But still, silver prices and gold prices relative to the S&P 500 or the Dow, I think, are going to go up over the next 5-6 years. And so that's why, so yeah, it's true, I'd rather have shares of corporate stock than have a bond, but I'd rather have an ounce of gold than shares of corporate stock. And the same thing with, like, with real estate too. That's partly why, like, for example, I was trying to sell my house, but I'm way underwater on it, and I was going to take a huge hit. And so I had it up for sale for a couple months, and I wasn't getting any good offers, and I just took it off as I saw the price inflation starting to kick in, because I think if I wait a year, probably I'm going to get a higher dollar price for my house than I'm going to get right now. Although there, it's a little bit hard to say. If I were starting from scratch and I just had $100,000 and I wanted to do something with it, there's no way I would buy a house right now. I would buy gold and silver. But my point is, since I'm stuck with the house and I can't get rid of it except by taking a huge hit right now, I may just ride it out, even though I would much rather not own this house and just be renting for a really cheap place, but that's not really an option for me right now without taking a huge hit and then having this fixed debt that I'd have to service. So I don't know if that's helping you. So again, but why? Because like if the dollar crashes, let's say the dollar falls 90% against other currencies, I'm thinking the real estate market ultimately would benefit because foreign investors would be able to snatch up properties in the United States at a bargain. So if you're just, you know, you're some guy in Japan and you want to own a beachfront house in Florida, if the dollar falls 90% against the yen, all of a sudden those houses are ridiculously cheap from the Japanese guy's point of view. So he can afford to offer a higher dollar price for it. So that might push up the dollar price of houses in the United States. Of course, that only works because then a lot of the stuff in the U.S. would be owned by foreigners. So it's not like it's a good thing in terms of what most people think of when they think of a strong, healthy economy, that the dollar crashes and then all these foreigners buy up U.S. wealth. But if you're somebody trying to sell your house, the fact that all of a sudden now it's a lot cheaper to foreigners might make them more willing to do it, so you get a better price for it. Okay, we got time for one more question. Trevor says, my focus in life has not been economics. In 2002, I started to notice the, quote, economic experts, namely Keynesians, didn't make sense. Things weren't adding up. In my opinion, the debate last night confirmed that Keynesians stick to the aggregate, all the while ignoring common sense. More specifically, I'm thinking of the comments regarding the housing bubble. Does this annoy you as well? How is it that a guy like Krugman is, quote, the mainstream, and Keynesians are at the forefront and has such a loud voice? I'm very interested to hear how you think this can be changed. How can Austrians become more, quote, mainstream and have a greater voice, have a greater impact on policy and general public discourse? So what he's referring to was in the debate at one point, Carl Smith, so I had presented my quick condensed version of Austrian business cycle theory, and then Carl was trying to poke holes in that, and so he was looking at things like business investment and housing investment and so forth during the bubble years and saying, what are you talking about? You know, investment is going up in capital, and you were claiming there was capital consumption. And so he wanted me to sort of tell him what Fred graphs, you know, from the put out by the St. Louis Fed, were those computer-generated graphs that Krugman uses a lot, and I use a lot too, just it's very convenient because the Fed has a lot of data, and they have this very convenient and powerful graphing tool. So a lot of people, a lot of bloggers, now when they want to illustrate something, they use a Fred-generated graph. That's sort of like now the industry standard among economics bloggers. So Carl was basically asking me, how do we know that the what you're calling the housing bubble years were unsustainable from an Austrian point of view? How do you know that we couldn't just kept doing that and kept real GDP growing on that trend line? He wanted me to point to some sort of, you know, falsifiable statistical test. And I admitted to him, and I think this is one of the few points where he sort of had me in terms of the debate. I said, yeah, I can't off the top of my head give you some data series to go look at that. Oh, see here, you know, it turned negative, and therefore we know that this boom is unsustainable. But what I ended up doing was just saying, look, just because I can't give you an operational test or criterion, that doesn't mean we're not sure if the housing bubble was unsustainable. Of course it was unsustainable. I mean, just use your common sense. How can anyone who lived through that not recognize that the gains, the feeling of prosperity from 2004 to 2006 was false, and that we could not have kept that up, that no economic policies they could have put in place would have allowed the indefinite perpetuation of the American way of life from 2004 to 2006, that was unsustainable. And I pointed to something saying, well, look, the vacancy rate among houses was going up during that time. So a larger and larger stock of houses was just purely speculative investment, that people were buying houses not to live in and not even to rent out, but just to hold while the price went up and then try to flip it. So I said, clearly that's unsustainable. You can't get to the point where 100% of the housing stock is just being held to be sold in the future, because then people don't have a place to live. So I said, you know, that clearly is unsustainable. But he wanted metrics showing what I had called capital consumption. So I guess coming back to your specific question, Trevor, part of it is mainstream economists, they want to be scientific, and they shy away from being ideological or dogmatic, and so the Austrian approach to a lot of them smacks of being religious almost, that you know, you guys self-consciously say that you have an a priori theoretical structure from this guy Mises that you hold in awe, and that you almost proudly say that you don't derive your theories from looking at the data. So aren't you just being a bunch of medieval scholastics as opposed to being empirical scientists? That we have our hypotheses, we go test them against the data, and if the data support them, then we think, okay, that's good. If they reject them, then we go back to the drawing board. But you guys, you just have your views, and no matter what happens in the real world, you just walk around thinking you're right. Well, that's not scientific. So that's part of what's going on. And just the very nature of it, like I was trying to explain to Carl, you know, with that gnome story, for example, that's what I was using that story to try to illustrate. That if you just took macro aggregate statistics and took a snapshot of that economy the day before and the day after the gnomes did their thing, it would look like there was a serious puzzle. Because you'd say, gee, we had the same amount of capital, we had the same amount of labor. It's not that we forgot how to make stuff. Our technology is the same. So how come our production function doesn't work anymore? And clearly the answer would just be, well, the location of the capital goods was a huge part of the issue. But how would you, you know, what Fred graph would you point to illustrate my gnome story? There really wouldn't be. There would just be this inexplicable crash in measured real output, even though the statistics showing business investment and stuff like that would all be going fine until the day before the crash. So for a lot of guys, that just, they would rather have something, and this is not my formulation, people have said this before, the mainstream would rather be very precise even if they're wrong, whereas the Austrians would rather be right even if it's vaguely right, that, you know, that they can't give some real crisp quantitative statement. They can just say stuff like, this bubble is unsustainable and there's going to be an economic crash, but we can't tell you what GDP growth is going to be next quarter. We have no idea. That's not the kind of stuff that we Austrians do. But what we can tell you is these policies are bad and it's setting the economy up for a crash. So for some economists, that's not very satisfying. They don't want to talk with you. They would much rather give projections quarter by quarter of GDP growth over the next 2 years and give their confidence intervals and all this bells and whistles. And even if they're totally wrong, at least they think they're being scientific. And they can say, well, we'll just take that into account and increase our error bands next time. That kind of stuff. Okay. Well, I got to stop there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And remember, like I say, just keep occasionally checking the syllabus for this sovereign debt crisis class, because I am going to be adding stuff. For sure, I'll be adding stuff for the fourth week. I'm not sure at this point if I'm going to need anything for the third week.